I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development, and we have a full day with looking at, for the first time, university governance and institutional boards. A bit of housekeeping before we go. We need to introduce some committee measures to be turned into legislation. So, Senator Knope, if you could get us going on that.
Yes, Chair House, I move LC 3682.
Yes,
sir.
Let me open up a work session for purposes of introducing committee.
There we go. Chair House, I move that LC 3682 dated January 31, 2013 be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Knope moves that LC 3682 dated January 1st, 2013 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objection? See none? So ordered. And I would like to open up a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 270. And I'd like to begin with Representatives Mark Johnson and Dembro, if he's here. There he is. These two gentlemen, who along with me, co-chaired the task force that's been meeting for the past year on the issue of university governance and institutional boards. And I think it was a pretty productive process, and the work that we ended up with is embodied in Senate Bill 270. And first, thanks to you gentlemen for holding that together and working so hard, and we're hoping that maybe you can kind of put in, set the stage for very briefly what we're looking at here.
I always bad cleanup.
Actually, I better get in first.
Yeah. For the record, Mark Johnson, State Rep for House District 52. Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. Great to be here today. Thanks for giving us a chance to talk about the work that the Interim Task Force put in on this important piece of legislation. I think that the impetus behind the task force that we served on, it actually was a committee bill that passed out of House Higher Ed in the February of 12, was born out of a desire that we heard frequently in our committee last session about the desire for and need for greater autonomy regarding higher ed governance. So we put together a draft that would where the committee could focus on some specific issues and come away with some specific recommendations about what we felt would be a pathway for specific institutions to be able to have that ability, but also then to provide a pathway for others who might want to choose a more independent pathway to go that direction too. So I think Representative Dembro will echo my sentiments, and I would assume Chair Haas, you would as well, that we at the time of completion, we made no inferences that this was a complete work, that there wouldn't be need for further amendments and or additions to that. So we fully understand that and acknowledge that, but we do think it provides a good framework to work within and to build upon, and I think it can accomplish what something that can be good for all of Oregon, again, as we all are kind of led by that that aspirational goal of achieving 40-40-20, and recognizing that in order for that to occur, we're going to have to do things a bit different in this state in some fashion. So I think this provides a good framework. Just a comment about the process itself. You know, I'm kind of a process guy. I can have a lot better confidence in an outcome if I understand a thoroughness about the, how the process was conceived to put this together. But the committee members all participated in some very significant ways. Senator Beyer was a great contributor, and others, and we came together, I think, in a very, from a lot of very different perspectives, but I think as we came to a completion, I think we all agreed that this is a good framework to work within. So obviously there is more work to be done. I think the end product, whatever that would be, needs to make sure that whatever we do as a legislature is really good for all of our higher ed institutions. It's important that everybody feel like they have a place, and that what we do is good for all of them, so they can continue to expand, to thrive, and again, as I said, to be able to fill their important niche in achieving 40-40-20, because that is really the guiding directive here too. There. So with that, I'll pass off to my colleague and allow him to take it away.
Thank you. I'm Michael Dembro. I represent House District 45, Northeast Portland to Park Rose. I, too, was a co-chair of the Special Joint Committee. I'm currently the chair of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. And, you know, I think that Representative Johnson hit it just right. Last February, we had a lot of interest was expressed in our pursuing this issue. We knew that this subject was too important and too complicated to be dealt with in a short session like February, let alone even a long session, that it needed deliberate, lengthy, transparent investigation of these issues. And so we did that, you know, between I think we put into the legislation wisely that we had to meet by the middle of April and then have our work done by the fall. And we did stick to that schedule. We met every couple of weeks. It's a lot of work, a real commitment. And you know, in the end, what we found was that there can be value to universities having their own boards. But there can also be danger if it's not done right. Because we also want to maintain the benefits of having a coordinated, articulated post-secondary system in this state. And so, you know, one of the early things that we did was develop a set of principles that whatever details we end up with, we wanted to get the vision out there and the principles, and then the details would be worked out in order to meet the goals of those principles. And, you know, as Representative Johnson said, this lengthy document that you have before you, it's lengthy, but it still has a lot of questions that need to be worked out. And that's going to be our job this session, is to get those details worked out. But I do want you to really pay attention to the principles that the findings that are the prologue to this bill. And I just want to very quickly walk you through them, okay, if you'll indulge me. If you look at Section 1, the Legislative Assembly finds that the state of Oregon may benefit from having public universities with institutional boards that, A, provide transparency, public accountability, and support for the university. So that's what these boards will be close to home, but they will be doing their business as public bodies in a very transparent accountable to the public. They are close to and closely focused on the individual university. They do not negatively impact public universities that do not have institutional boards. Again, we have to try to find that sweet spot. They'll lead to greater access and affordability for Oregon residents and do not disadvantage Oregon students relative to out-of-state students. Okay, just to be candid, there is concern out there that local boards will be so focused on their individual universities that they'll pile on with out-of-state students who pay higher tuition rates, and the integrity of these institutions as Oregon universities will be lost. E are similar to the State Board of Higher Education in composition, constitution, and transparency. Okay. It's taking that, essentially what the State Board of Higher Ed does, but moving them close to the individual university. They have a dual fiduciary responsibility to the university and to the state of Oregon as a whole. G, they promote the academic success of students in support of the mission of all education beyond high school as described in ORS 351009. The overall mission of the universities remains the same. And the Legislative Assembly also finds that, A, there are economy of scale benefits to having a coordinated university system. B, shared services may continue to be shared among universities, even if they have their own boards. And C, Ownership of all university property, whether acquired before or after the creation of an institutional board, through state funding, revenue bonds, or philanthropy, resides with the people of Oregon. We do envision a higher opportunity for universities to do revenue bonding together with, you know, in coordination with the treasurer, state treasurer's office, that's spelled out later in the bill. But we are envisioning that. We're also envisioning a higher level of philanthropy coming as a result of these boards. But the buildings that are constructed are still university. They belong to the people of Oregon. The boards are the agents, but the ownership is with the people. And finally, the Legislative Assembly has a responsibility to monitor the success of institutional boards at fulfilling their missions, their compacts, and the principles stated in this section. So there are processes that we put in place for regular reviews by the legislature through the OEIB. So that is, you know, kind of the framework to all this. And I would say that the areas that we still need to really work on in terms of fleshing out this framework, you know, is the area of shared services, making sure that economies of scale are maintained, and, you know, to what extent can institutions do their own thing, or are they part of shared services in terms of, well, a variety of things. Ensuring a coordinated academic system, that too is important. We don't want to turn the creation of programs into just a free-for-all without having a real sense of, where is the best place to have certain programs? How can we encourage partnerships between programs? How can we make sure that those statewide programs that have to do with forestry or LERC, the labor education group at the University of Oregon, how they're able to work in coordination and combination? The issue of board composition, who sits on the boards, how many on these boards will be from the university community, students, faculty, staff. And finally, you know, there are questions out there about the future of the regional universities, the teaching universities. And all of those things need to be treated with great deliberation and great care, because we don't want to screw this up. So that's the charge that I give us all as we pursue this over the next 5 months.
Well, thank you both for being so thoughtful on this issue, and it was a pleasure to work with both of you and the way you reasoned through this. I appreciate you walking us through those, that preamble there to remind me and Senator Beyer and to make sure that this is the page we're on here. The task force was adopted unanimously a few months ago, and you're right, there will be some blanks to fill in. I'm working with the universities and students and others on amendments. There will be a considerable amending here, but I think our pledge here is to whatever amendments go in, they fill in the blanks, and they do not veer from what our task force unanimously agreed to in terms of a concept, and that's really the goal here. Aside from one thing, that is that Oregon State University has now, since we finished, said that it wants to have this as an option. So OSU will be added in one of the amendments here. But we do have a long list of technical amendments related to bonding and some other things, some of which may be controversial, I don't know, but there will be some technical amendments. And this is the university board structure part of the work we need to do. The other much larger part, frankly, is the one that is in the House Higher Education Committee there in terms of whether and how to restructure our educational system in terms of what to do with some of those boards. And perhaps Representative Dembro, you can go into where you are in that, mm-hmm. the status, and how these two may be married up down the road.
Right. Yeah, we're in the early stages of that, and let me just step back and say, you know, under our current governance system, we have the community colleges who report to one board. We have the universities that report to another board. We have OSAC, the Student Access Commission, which does the scholarships, the opportunity grants. They report to another board. And then we also have the HEC out there, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. And what, you know, many of us have been thinking about, gosh, there's got to be a way to do a better job of integrating those, right, so that they're working under the same roof, as it were, so that we have better coordination, cooperation, articulation among our colleges and universities, and also the workforce sector, right? So, you know, what we're looking at, and you know, we're nailing down the details, I think we may actually be seeing some legislation or some initial legislation this afternoon on this that's being drafted, but that would integrate the current CCWD, Community Colleges Workforce Development, the Oregon University System, and OSAC under a new Department of Postsecondary Education and Workforce Development that would be the, you know, the agency that would work on shared services and coordination, articulation of programs, all of those things that we think we could do a better job of in pursuit of 40-40-20. And the public board for all of those entities would be the HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. So this new department would support that public body. So that, in a nutshell, is what we're looking at. That one is going to most likely be many hundreds of pages long. So it's going to take a lot of time.
Why yeah, you guys said you say that.
I love a challenge. No, you know, we're committed, you know, on our side and, you know, I'm sure on your side, to making this a very transparent process. There will be significant opportunity for input. Public input from the universities, the colleges, students, the public, business community, everyone, again, to make sure that we get this right, that it's not just moving the deck chairs around.
Well, you guys have your work cut out for you on that assignment, but I just want to make the point that these are two very separate
correct
pieces of legislation.
They're separate, but they're closely related.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Just to if I may, Mr. Chair, just to add on to what Michael said, and I totally agree with his preamble to the bill. And I think for me personally, there's three main areas in the draft in front of you that I think need attention. One is what kind of governance do we have for those institutions that don't pursue their own independent boards? Two would be the issue of shared services, economies of scale. We obviously, it's all about access and affordability, and we have to allow them, do everything we possibly can to ensure the cost of tuition remain as low as possible so they can operate as efficiently as possible. Three, I think, is the makeup of the boards themselves. And I have no idea what kind of amendments you may be seeing, but I know from my own perspective, and Michael, I may share a different perspective here, but the whole concept behind a governing board is to allow it to be a strategic, leading governing board and so forth. I would just encourage you to resist the notion or the temptation that may come your way from certain entities to, i.e., follow the prescriptive path that the OEIB has taken, which I think the problem that I see there is that we have too many stakeholder representatives as a member of that group, and it's hard to make decisions about what is really best for Oregon education when you're just simply there representing folks behind you. You can operate much more independently and autonomously, I believe, if in fact you're there because you're equipped to provide and to lead and to make good strategic recommendations about what's best in the interest of the institution. So that's just my two cents.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, very good. Thank you both. That was, I mentioned it was a task force. It was legislators on both sides of the aisle. It was very bipartisan, but I think, frankly, it's more nonpartisan than anything else. It's just very practical. And one of those members of the task force was Senator Barr. Did you have something you wanted to add?
I would just comment that this is something that received an incredible amount of study, as the two representatives have said. During the interim, I would guess collectively we probably spent 100 hours on it, at least, and I think the recommendations that the Joint Committee brought forward were reasoned and well-founded.
Thank you. And one of the members of that task force is Matt Donegan. Mr. Donegan is a business leader in Portland, a background in the forest products industry, and he also has a unique perspective to this because he's not only on the State Board of Higher Education, he's also on the OEIB. So his input in this process continues to be high value. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Chair Hass. And with that introduction, I'm afraid almost everything I have to say is now redundant, having heard of the previous two speakers. But I do have some written comments that I can read to the record. So Chair Hass, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matt Donegan, and I am pleased to be here today as president of the State Board of Higher Education, a member of the Oregon Education Investment Board, and one of two members of the OEIB who served on the Special Committee on University Governance. In 2009, Chancellor Pernsteiner commissioned outgoing University of Oregon President Dave Frohnmayer to examine the changing needs of higher education. And the report that Mr. Frohnmayer delivered included the concept of institutional governing boards. This report was the first step in the development of legislation for the 2011 session. In 2010, Senator Hass and Representative Reed convened a legislative work group to study the issue of increased flexibility for higher education in order to deal with the ongoing declining levels of state support for our universities. And about this time, the State Board of Higher Education began investigating new governance models that would provide the university system with increased flexibility and while also insulating it from having tuition income diverted by the state to meet other financial obligations. And this conversation would eventually lead to the development of legislation you enacted last session, Senate Bill 242. During this process, the board also investigated the possibility for the State Board of Higher Education to establish governing boards for some or all of its universities. And the board brought in numerous nationally recognized consultants, examined the governance approaches taken in other states, and considered proposals from each of the seven university presidents. The presidents seeking institutional governing boards talked about two major advantages: the possibility of increased financial resources through donations or local tax income, and more direct advice that presidents could receive from board members devoted exclusively to their university rather than from members of a statewide entity providing advice regarding statewide issues. The board explored how such boards might be established and operated in a way that did not hinder the achievement of broader statewide policy goals. And based on many months of work assessing how institutional boards have worked in other states and getting input from all stakeholders, the board voted on a final recommendation for institutional boards. The recommendations were divided into, number one, powers reserved to the State Board of Higher Education, or a statewide entity. Number two, powers of institutional boards that require state approval. Number three, powers of institutional boards that require the advice and consent of the state board. And number four, powers that would be exercised in parallel by both the state board and institutional boards in their respective spheres. The final recommendation of the State Board of Higher Education was received by the Legislative Special Committee on University Governance during the summer of 2012. The special committee has been had been established after the issue of institutional boards was considered during the 2011 and 2012 legislative sessions. The committee met 10 times between April and September of 2012. In addition to reviewing the prior legislative work and the final recommendation of the State Board of Higher Education, the committee also heard from national experts, the governor, the presidents of all seven universities, the treasurer's office, representatives of students, faculty, alumni, and many other stakeholders. The testimony we heard formed the basis of the recommendation that Oregon may benefit from having public universities with institutional boards that do the following, as you've heard previously. Number one, provide transparency, public accountability, and support for the university. Number two, boards that are close, close to and closely focused on the individual university. Number three, do not negatively impact public universities that do not have institutional boards. Number four, lead to greater access and affordability for Oregon residents and do not disadvantage Oregon students relative to out-of-state students. Number five, are similar to the State Board of Higher Education in composition, constitution, and transparency. Number six, have a dual responsibility, fiduciary responsibility to the university and to the state of Oregon as a whole. And finally, promote the academic success of students in support of Oregon achieving the statutory goal of 40-40-20. And this recommendation resulted in the Senate bill you have before you today. While there are many details yet to be resolved by the Joint Committee on University Governance and the State Board of Higher Education have carefully considered these issues and are supportive of the establishment of institutional boards. And the bottom line for the State Board, and I believe the Joint Committee was and is, the needs of the state, including the important 40-40-20 goal, must be met by Oregon's public universities collectively, regardless of whether a campus has an institutional board or not. But institutional boards will likely assist in that collective mission. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I look forward to any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Duncan? When you look at this going forward in your activities in the board, your president, how do you plan for the how do you see this playing out with the governance issue over here, the board issues? What variables now are up there that you talking in terms of recruiting and planning?
Just how do we get through this transition period? You know, I think our primary, there's two goals. I mean, number one is the students are still there, and our primary goal is to serve our students. And I think that is a rallying call. It's why we're all there in the first place. And so I expect and have seen a very high degree of professionalism in terms of business as usual, conducting the business of the universities. Been very impressed by that. We will continue to staff as needed in order to do that through this legislative session. And at the same time, the board wants to, and the university system wants to position itself as the thought leader as the legislature continues to consider these issues. So we want to be here at your disposal. There's a lot of collective institutional knowledge working through the issues of shared services specifically. But also, as you think about some of the issues raised by Representative Johnson, Representative Dembro, in terms of what is the right governance on those for those universities that don't declare for an institutional board, the funding mechanisms that are envisioned to reside within the Department of Post-Secondary Education. There's a lot of granular, detailed work here, and I think the Chancellor's Office and university system is the natural expert and resource for the legislature to draw upon, and so we want to position ourselves to be that that resource.
Matt, there's two of the most significant features of this allow these universities to hire and fire president and to issue their own revenue bonds. And I was wondering if you, given your background in business, given your perch at OEIB and the board, if you can maybe flesh out or explain a little bit or articulate why those are so important.
Yeah, you know, I think the the main issue that that does get discussed is the hiring and firing of university presidents, and I think it stands to reason that if you're going to recruit a high caliber group of volunteers to serve as on a board, I think you want to have them invested in the ultimate success of that institution, have them invested in the development of the strategic plan and the execution of the strategic plan, and you want them ultimately accountable for the for delivering on that strategic plan and succeeding. I would be nervous of having a board that is commissioned and charged with executing a strategic plan that then does not have the ability to be to hire and fire its own president. That seems to a certain degree let that board off the hook in terms of the accountability around its delivering on its mission. So that then begs the question, well, this is a public university, and how then do you keep that university president and the board itself accountable to the state of Oregon? And so it's the board appointment process and the removal process that gets looked to ensure that public accountability.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz?
But in what you've got here, the governor basically has veto power over any selection that the board might make. So ultimately, one could say it's his decision.
Excuse me, over 270 in the specific language?
It says in consultation with the Board of Higher Ed and the governor. And so that basically means that the governor probably has the ultimate say or could potentially have the ultimate say. I'm just saying I like the idea of the CEO of an organization being accountable to the board. I think that's the way business works best.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure that this is quite to where you were describing. So.
Well, that doesn't give the governor veto power. We're pretty careful on that point. Consultation is not the same as...
It's a fine line, Mr. Chair.
It seems to a certain degree codify what would be prudent practices anyway. A consultation is a smart move anyway, and so this does again codify that. The real direct line, the operating line, Senator Cruz, that you're describing, is really not through the appointment process as much as of the president as much as it is through the board representatives.
Further questions?
If you look at the fact that section before the governor does do the appointing and then consults, it's still, if we're going for independence, I don't think we're quite there yet. As far as the internal structure of the university. Just maybe some fine points, but I think worth considering.
I just having been in those discussions where the specifics words were selected very carefully, I think that was intended, again, to codify a consultative approach without conveying a veto authority. And again, if part of the reason for doing this, just to speak somewhat plainly, if part of the reason for doing this is to protect the public mission, as is absolutely sacred, and I think we use that term quite a bit, while also availing the universities to private resources in a revenue-restricted environment where we really want to make this attractive to private investment, it seemed that really providing as much assurance or stability and also investment from those board members as possible while protecting that public mission was the balancing act that we were trying to create. Again, I think naming and hiring and firing the university presidents was seen as a real key piece to that.
Well, I think Senator Cruz raises a good point, but I think the words, as Mr. Donegan has said, have been chosen with a sense to maximum flexibility within political reality and sensitivity. And largely, when we were dealing with this, we were looking to the model of OHSU, which has worked very successfully since we did that in the mid-90s.
Further questions? Mr. Donegan, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
We may be leaning on you before this process is through. Thanks. George Bernsteiner, the Chancellor of the Oregon University System.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Members of the committee, for the record, George Bernsteiner, Chancellor of the Oregon University System. Thank you for allowing me to be here today and to speak with you in general support of the concept of Senate Bill 270. I've been asked today to talk a little bit about governance in the universities across the country and how we fit into that, and then specifically about this particular bill and these kinds of proposals that are before you today. But before I do that, I want to thank Senator Hass, Representative Johnson, and Representative Dembro for their leadership of the interim committee on this matter. I want to thank the members of the State Board of Higher Education for the thought leadership they provided in the proposal that they made, which I will, in fact, cite from time to time. And President Frohnmayer, who sort of kicked this off at my request about now 3.5 years ago. But I would be remiss if I did not mention that the gentleman who put many of these ideas into President Frohnmayer's mind, Jerry Kissler, who was the senior vice provost at the University of Oregon for many years, is here today. And since he's been working on this longer probably than anybody else in the room, I did want to recognize his attendance. I also want to thank Presidents Cullinan and Maples for being here. This bill is important not just to the University of Oregon and to Portland State University, but to all the universities in this state. And how, in fact, it evolves over the course of this session will have a great impact on them, on their students, and on the success of the state. And so when Representative Dembro said, "Don't screw it up," I think he had in mind some of the institutions other than those who are already embedded in this bill. Governance of public universities in this country varies from state to state and is, I think, a function more of history, tradition, past decisions, and policy focus of a given state than it is to anything else. There is no one single model that is more associated with student success than any other. There are several basic types of governance for public universities in this country. The most common structure, a single board for all the universities in the state, is the one we now have. More states have that structure than any other single structure. But there are at least a half a dozen other structures that are prevalent in different parts of the country. You look to the south of us at California, and you'll see two major systems of universities, University of California and Cal State, both of which are multi-campus systems with very different missions. You look to the north of us, you see Washington, where the University of Washington and Washington State University are multi-campus systems with a single board, but the other more regional institutions also have their own boards. So you can see, even along the West Coast, a significant difference in governance from state to state. A few states have statewide governing boards along with institutional governing boards with different powers for each of the types of boards. And in fact, North Carolina, Florida, Utah, states like that are indicative of it. There are some small states that have systems for their access universities with a board for that and then a separate board for the flagship. Vermont, Connecticut, states like that come to mind in that regard. So, as you can see, the 50 states organize differently across them. No one single approach has led to more student success than any other single approach. So there is no magic silver bullet here that you can find that will solve all of the state's ills by just making a governance change. The universities here in Oregon are more successful today than they have ever been in the state's history. It's not just more students, which you already know, but it's actually more degrees, better retention, more research, all of the metrics that you look at that are in your performance report for the universities show better results today than ever before in history. And we've finally, in the last year or so, begun to reverse the trend of the past few decades that's seen young adults with lower education levels than their elders, beginning now to change that, which is something that we have talked about with this committee in the last two or three sessions. So progress is, in fact, being made. So we are getting on to the path to reach our 40-40-20 goal, although there's a lot more work that's needed. Student success today is important. Student success tomorrow is imperative. Because as the world becomes more global, more competitive, and more dependent upon
Education as the coin of the realm that determines whether or not a state or a region or any other sub-entity is successful, it becomes much more important for us to actually achieve that 40-40-20 goal if Oregonians are to be successful and competitive. So no matter how successful we are today, and we are, in comparison to anything we've been in the past, it's not going to be enough. That's not enough for the future. We, in fact, have to be more successful. We have to be more successful in our universities for our students. Student success, as Representative Johnson said, with regard to 40-40-20, that really is the guiding light that must be what we follow, both as you look at this bill, but as all of us work on education in this state. This bill would establish institutional boards for some of Oregon's universities, apparently now about to be three. But I think it ought also to allow for the sustainable achievement of all of them. If it does that, it could help set the state and its citizens up for greater success. It could, in fact, make it more possible for this state and our citizens to achieve 40-40-20. But as Representative Dembrough indicated, we've got to do it right. And I think that requires four conditions. The first is public oversight. You had conversation with Chair Donegan about public oversight just now. It's very important to maintain a public connection to public universities. That connection has to be more than just the level of appropriations. Part of that is because our level of appropriations in this state is among the lowest in the entire country. There is no university in this state which gets more money from the state than it does from its students. None. We have crossed that path, that boundary a long time ago, so that for every one of the universities, unlike their colleagues in community colleges and K-12, the bulk of their money comes not from government sources, but from student sources. That means that we have to look at student affordability, but it also means that we have to look at the motivations of universities being not the same as those for other public entities, because their bottom lines are dependent upon being able to attract students who pay money. But that isn't always in the state's best interest as the single motivating factor. And that's why the state needs to have more than just appropriations as its connection to the universities. And that connection has been talked about some with regard to property ownership by Representative Dembrough, which it isn't just the ownership of the property in the name of the people in the state of Oregon. It's also the ability to encumber that property. Should that encumbrance, should mortgaging it or selling it, be subject to some kind of state oversight, so that you can maintain a connection between the university and the state into the future? The board membership is important. Who appoints the board is even more important. You've got to make sure that it is the state, it is the governor who appoints the board. I think your bill does that, but there will be those who say, well, you know, the state doesn't put in most of the money, so should they? We've had these debates. Keep that. Keep that close to you. Because if you're going to be successful in future, you have got to have connections to the universities who have multiple motivations, all of them well-meaning, but not all of them may be aligned with those of the state itself. The second, if the first is public oversight, the second is participation in a shared enterprise. You've heard both Representative Dembrough in the principles and Chair Donegan, as he spoke with you, talk about shared enterprise. Let me say a little bit about that. Participation in a shared services enterprise connects the individual universities with one another. We have spent the last decade trying to connect the universities and the community colleges much more closely together, programmatically and in terms of their goals and orientation. We've got to find ways to maintain that connection, and shared services becomes one of those. It is a way of connecting for the public interest, but it also is a way of saving money. Economies of scale can be gotten with the volumes that are talked about. And that's particularly true when you take a look at the fact that some of our universities are not in major metropolitan areas and therefore do not have the ability for volume buying in Portland. You've got to find a way to make sure that you can connect the universities through shared services in order to keep costs down for students. It's Oregon's undergraduate students that you're focused on here and the cost that is charged to them. Most of the money that goes to the universities is paid by those students. It's not paid by the state. And therefore, holding that cost down, and shared services is one way to do it, is in fact important. But shared services are more than what we commonly think about. It's more than just the back office payroll and accounting and purchasing. But it also, in this era, includes the ability to share courses and the ability to share instructional technology. You can't ignore the changes that are happening in the higher education world and not try to take advantage of those through a variety of sharing mechanisms. In the last major session in 2011, you enacted Senate Bill 242. I would argue that the principal benefit of 242 will in fact be shared services. Because you freed the universities from being part of the state bureaucracy, you have allowed them flexibility, and so now let's take advantage of that through the collective sharing of shared services. Obviously, those services can take a lot of forms. You know, it can be centrally provided. It can be provided by one of the institutions on behalf of the others, third party. It doesn't really matter. What we need is a viable and sustainable mechanism for shared services if we are to preserve the public nature of the universities and fulfill the promise of 40-40-20. And that promise is that all Oregonians succeed, regardless of where they live, regardless of how much money they make, regardless of what their racial background might be. And that leads to my next point. If the first point was you have to have public oversight, and the second was you have to have a meaningful mechanism for shared services, the third becomes you have to have sustainable, viable regional institutions. We cannot meet our 40-40-20 goals, particularly in the rural parts of this state, and we cannot meet our equity responsibilities if competition among the universities harms some institutions for the benefit of others, and we cannot find a way to provide access and student success everywhere in the state. This is very important. This is not just about individual institutions. It's about the state interest. The state has an interest in the success of Southern Oregon University, OIT, Eastern Oregon University, Western Oregon University, Portland State University, all of the universities in meeting the state's goals. We cannot meet the state's goals without all of them. And all of them have to be viable, sustainable enterprises. But the real reason that we're looking at this is that it gives us a way to reach 40-40-20 better than we've got right now. Well, what is that way? What is that way? Because it has the potential to unlock financial resources that are not otherwise available to us. I want to spend a minute on that because I think it's very important, and it fundamentally ought to be the driving force here. We are a state that, for a variety of reasons, has not been able and willing to invest in higher education in the past. We have one of the lowest investments per student in the country. I can bemoan that, but it doesn't change the fact. It is also likely that our rate of growth in the state general fund is not going to be especially robust in any time that we can foresee in the short term. It's not. That also, I can lament that too, but it isn't going to change it. It is also true that our resident undergraduate students come from families whose incomes are lower than the national average. I can lament that too, but it isn't going to change it. Oregon has a lower income demographic than does the national average. Not only that, but the students whom we have educated in years past come from higher income backgrounds than those we will have to educate to meet 40-40-20. If you take a look at the demographics of Oregon schools today, you can see that the income characteristics of the families of those students are lower than the ones we've seen in the past. We've got to educate more students, we've got to get greater penetration, and we've got to do it with a group that doesn't have the money to pay us in the way that that they did before. So that even if we get somewhat more state money, and we ought to, for 40-40-20, we don't have a group of students who can afford to pay the freight. So we have to find a new way of finding money. Now, we can talk about recasting the financial aid system, and that's important, and it is a piece. But really, we have to bring new money into the equation. Money that is not state money, money that is not paid by our resident undergraduate students, but money that comes from elsewhere. And that money has to come for one or more of five things. It can't just be general money. It has to be for faculty, for advisors, for classrooms, for instructional technology, and for need-based financial aid. In other words, it has to focus on the core of the mission of the instructional part of the universities so that students can be successful. Finding ways to bring in that money is really the key here, the key motivator behind this bill. That's one of the things the president's made clear when they talked with the state board. And it's one of the things I emphasize that you take a look at as you go forward. Find a way to make that a reality. Find a way to bring that new money in. Because, frankly, that's the only way we're going to get to 40-40-20. It's the major reason to support this bill, I think. The State Board of Higher Ed last June provided you with a proposal on how to establish institutional boards. And I commend that to you. I commend it to you because they considered over many months and in consultation with a lot of different people in different groups, a variety of public policy issues, all of which you're going to have to confront as you work this bill through. You may, and I'm almost certain that you will, choose somewhat different paths on individual items than did the state board, but because they address these issues, you might be able to use some of their work, some of their thoughts, to help inform the process going forward. To summarize, I get done. There is no one right way to organize public higher education. I support the concept of institutional boards as a way to provide more private money to help educate Oregonians to help us meet our 40-40-20 goals. But I believe we must consider the impact of creating such boards on the viability of all seven universities. We must ensure that the state has the connections and the levers to influence universities to meet public policy goals, and we have to establish a viable and sustainable mechanism for universities to share services and programs in order to hold down the costs of education so that student tuition can be held as low as possible. I thank you so much for the opportunity to meet with you here today and for the opportunity I've had in past sessions to meet with this committee. I look forward to working with you as long as you will have me to try to work through this bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chancellor. That was very eloquently stated. Perhaps maybe the best summary of why we're here doing this bill that I've been exposed to. I should have pointed out before you did that our universities, in my opinion as well, are running now about as good as they ever have been at history, and that they're doing that at a point when the state funding on a per-student basis is at a low point in history. And that's in no small part to your leadership over the last decade. So we appreciate your service there. And I do appreciate you talking about the potential philanthropy as one of the drivers behind this. It is very important, and sometimes we get caught up in the details. Sometimes we argue about the details here, but it's important to keep the big picture in mind. Some questions for Chancellor? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We do have a sign-up sheet of some people who would like to go on record on this, and let me just go down the list in no particular order. Mark Nissenfeld.
Good afternoon, Chairman Haas and committee members. Thank you for having me. My name is Mark Nissenfeld. I'm a member of the Service Employees International Union, Local 503. SEIU represents about 4,000 classified workers who support students and faculty at all seven universities. We work in food service, grounds maintenance, facilities maintenance, and custodial services, office, IT, and administrative support, and we staff the campus libraries, to name just a few of our responsibilities. I serve on the SEIU Board of Directors as well as chair our Higher Ed Council. I also chair our bargaining team, and I'm president of our local at Portland State University. For my day job, I work as a development engineer where I design and build custom apparatus for research scientists and graduate students at PSU. I've been at PSU for 20 years, and I love having the opportunity to contribute to the higher education of Oregonians and to research that advances our knowledge in many areas. I'm here today to provide testimony of our concerns around Senate Bill 270, the so-called pathway for institutional boards at the University of Oregon and Portland State University. We are presently opposed to Senate Bill 270 as we await someone to provide a compelling argument for any benefits that will be created by this bill. If these institutional boards are, in fact, created, we are strong supporters of having internal campus representatives serve as voting members on each of them. Over the last several years, our union's Higher Education Council drafted a set of principles that were adopted by our entire union. These principles included the following approach to institutional boards, and I quote, "A majority of the members of such boards should be elected from the community and represent students, faculty, and classified staff. What we envision is a body that has democratic roots and accountability and that relies on the experiences and knowledge that internal representatives, those who work and study on campus, can bring to these boards. Would you create an advisory and governance body for this legislature that didn't include the folks who worked within? I think that's highly unlikely. We also strongly suggest that students, faculty, and classified staff be able to elect their representatives. Furthermore, we would suggest holding jurisdictional elections for some of the designated at-large positions, similar to the way community colleges elect their board members. We see this as a way to further ensure a level of democracy and accountability that only predictable and contested elections can provide. Some other concerns we have about the pathway that is Senate Bill 270 are: local institutional boards will cost the state more money and divide Oregon's higher education communities instead of a unified OUS request to the legislature. Individual universities will use regional political clout to squeeze money out of the system in competition with the other universities. We understand that institutional local boards will cost somewhere between $3 million and $8 million for each board per year. That's an estimate done by the State Board of Higher Education's Governance and Policy Committee in a March 16, 2012 presentation. Added functions per campus include legal, audits, board support and communication, risk management, treasury, and payroll, to name a few. Senate Bill 270 is insufficient at describing how, quote, shared services, unquote, currently under OUS will be divided up and or provided. New local boards will bloat administration on the backs of students. In preparation for having a local board, in the last 16 years, University of Oregon has increased administrative costs by 166%, and PSU has increased them by 144%, in comparison to OSU, where their increase was only 85%. Present language in this bill around the charge of local boards grants their universities the power to increase student in-state tuition costs up to 5% per year without having to attain legislative approval. There's currently no language that controls graduate student tuition increases or increases for out-of-state student tuition. We believe in statewide oversight of tuition as a way of continuing to keep system schools more affordable and truly public. I do want to thank the authors and acknowledge your determination that and I quote Section 7, Number 2, Letter C, institutional boards shall participate in a collective bargaining partnership with the statewide Board of Higher Education and members of other institutional boards for the purpose of entering into collective bargaining agreements with the statewide bargaining organizations of the employees of the universities, end quote. It is essential that we remain a statewide unit for bargaining wages, benefits, and working conditions. It is troubling to me that the word public was always prominent in this clause of earlier bill drafts until the most recent legislative iteration, such as in the employees of the public university. That phrase, public university, is what we are concerned about and why we are presently testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 270. We don't think these boards can be afforded with all that is going on in this economy, with educational overhauls in the state, and with the insecurity of our resources. Finally, we want to make sure that any legislation around governance keeps all campus property in the ownership of the citizens of the state of Oregon. They should be maintained and treated as just that, public treasures in state ownership. Thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Emma Calloway.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Emma Calloway. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association, and we represent over 100,000 students at Oregon's public universities and community colleges. And as the chancellor was saying, we are over 50% of the financial stakeholders of our institutions. So I'm here to share with you today some concerns that we have about this bill.
Thank you. But we do have your written statement if you want to.
That is the statement we gave to the OEIB, so I'm just going to run through a quick summary and definitely not read that to you. So I'm aware that this is the first of many hearings for SB 270, and there will be much discussion in the coming months, and we want to participate early and often in the process so that we can have a healthy debate about this issue and ultimately participate and ultimately contribute to a result that will be best for Oregonians seeking public post-secondary education. There are a lot of possibilities when it comes to the ever-developing structure of our post-secondary education system, and we're not opposed to change, nor do we wish to advocate for the status quo. But we do have concerns regarding the current proposals for institutional boards for PSU, U of O, and possibly Oregon State, and I'd like to go through some of our major hang-ups just so that we're clear up front about some of our concerns. So first, right now, a statewide system of schools means that there is one general funding allocation system that reviews the requests of all seven OUS institutions, and that board decides what's best for Oregon. This process works best when all institutions are held to the same standard, as opposed to some schools getting to appeal to a board just focused on what's best for one campus. We suggest that a statewide board maintain their role in allocating state dollars, whether that be OUS, the HEC, or the OEIB. It's unclear which is best, but an oversight board is important to us. And the same logic applies with capital construction requests and program approval, ensuring that we think about the needs of all campuses and limit unnecessary competition. And we know that this has been a concern of Oregon State, as they have previously opposed similar legislation. Although that they're asking now for an institutional board, they want to be clear that they don't want to be at a competitive disadvantage. And so we're worried about that competition. We also hope that we have a debate about tuition setting authority. If we do end up raising tuition to that 5% cap, tuition will skyrocket in the next decade, and we need to be more careful than that. We also have questions about how many out-of-state students it will take for a school to be able to guarantee a 5% cap in tuition, also commenting on that out-of-state, in-state ratio question. So I just have two others. We have questions about shared services, as the Chancellor and Chair Donegan talked about, and other cost-cutting benefits that come from an economies of scale system, which Representative Johnson mentioned. Finally, frankly, we're shocked that after much discussion over the last year, we still don't see faculty and staff and students represented on these proposed boards, and that's very surprising to us. As you can see, we have questions and concerns about competition and how the rest of the system will continue to support our regional schools. We want to avoid unnecessary cost increases that often come with the further development of governing boards. I will leave you today with the flow charts that we made for you. These are just flow charts that we make for the students that I work for. We hope that if we're going to this type of model, that we actually are thinking strategically about whether we need all of these layers, which boards are necessary, and which costs, because this model is frankly very different than where we were from the pre-2011 legislative session. And finally, as I mentioned, we'll leave you with a copy of our OEIB testimony. So that testimony really reflects that the board that you all are working on is very much linked to the board that's to the discussion that's going on in the House Higher Education Committee. And we recognize that they're two separate bills and appreciate that. But we want to make sure that at the end of the day, we are being careful and making sure that we're thinking about the needs of the entire system or what's left of the Oregon University system and those pieces. We are more supportive of the changes in the other bill, but we'd like to have discussions about this bill as well. We certainly appreciate the possibility of increased philanthropy, and we know that what is most important is that at the end of the day, our public institutions are there to provide quality education for Oregonians at an affordable price on any campus that a student chooses. So not just our big three, but really any place that a student wants to go in this state. So we're asking if we make further changes to our system that we do so holistically and with cost and competition in mind. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Emma. Questions for Emma Calloway of the Oregon Student Association. That was good. Emma is always good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Joel Fisher.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher, Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Business Association, although I'm not actually senior to everybody there. It's just the title they gave me. The Oregon Business Association is committed to improving access to post-secondary education, and it's one of our key pillars in moving closer to our goals of 40-40-20, and we see university autonomy as one of those key pillars. You have my testimony. I'll be really brief. Just want to outline a few of our key points. Support providing institutional boards to universities that want one. Grant institutional boards the statutory authority to hire and fire the president. Authorize institutional boards to issue bonds. Authorize institutional boards to set tuition with a limit set by the legislature. Provide broad governing authorities and statute to institutional boards to achieve the public mission of the university. Require universities' institutional boards to enter into an achievement compact directly with the Oregon Education Investment Board to increase accountability, and continue to require universities to coordinate with other universities, community colleges, and school districts. And to borrow a line from the governor, we kind of see this as playing it tight, loose, tight on outcomes, loose on how you get there. That's all.
Very good. We appreciate your input and your help. Any questions for Joel, OBA? Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, that's all the testimony, we sign up testimony we have and the invited testimony. There will be amendments coming. As mentioned, some of you are working with the universities and the students to develop some fine-tuning to the concept that was unanimously approved by a task force in the fall. And so we will see this bill a lot more in the coming weeks. Thank you all. Thank you, committee. There's no further business. We're adjourned. Thank you.